How do you cope when the road is really tough, when you don't know how to take the next step, when you feel like perhaps you're on a hilltop completely covered in cloud and you can't see anything and you just don't know what's coming, when life has given you such a kicking that you can barely hold things together, when life hurts and there seems absolutely no way out, when it's not as though there's just one thing that's gone wrong, but a whole series of things that keep challenging us. What then is your attitude to God when you could be forgiven for thinking, he's abandoned me, he just doesn't care, and you just want to know why? Ever felt like that? Be honest. Let me rephrase it. Is there anyone in this room for whom that's not been true at some point or other, to ask those questions, thinking, Lord, what on earth is going on in this situation I'm bombarded with? Well, that is the story of Job. And I'm sure most of you know the story of Job very well. You know how it begins in chapter 1. The man is introduced, and he's a man who is faithful to God. He loved God. God described him as being an upright man. No one compared to him in the world. And everything seemed to be going well. He had family, he had wealth, he had property. It was all wonderful. And this man continued to be faithful and praise God, right up until the point where God allowed Satan to take it all away. At which point we then see a man in his utter torment and grief start to ask those really tough questions. And if you were in his situation, I wonder what your response would be. Then we get chapter 2. And he doesn't just lose all the things around him. Then his health is impacted. His body's covered in sores. It is horrific. But then come his friends, chapter 3 onwards, his comforters. And if you know the passage and you know what his comforters were like, in a sense, well-meaning as they were, standing by him as they did, who needs friends like them? People who gave advice, who shared their opinions, who made their judgments, and their essential conclusion was this: if something's going wrong in your life so badly, you must have sinned incredibly badly. Therefore, you need to confess to God. They wrongly assumed that suffering always comes as a consequence of sin. How many people does that apply to who assume that? That's really dreadful theology. It's not Christianity. Actually, it's more like Buddhism. That's karma. What goes around comes around. If you've done something, something's going badly for you, it's because you've done something wrong. That's not the way our God operates. But Job had questions, and he refuted their comments, but he still had these big questions of God. He was asking why. But they were not the only players in this story. Someone else, this young man, Elihu, who appears from chapter 32 onwards. He's a young man, and in deference to the elderly, supposedly wiser comforters that had come to Job, he'd kept quiet. In chapters 32 to 37, it says, oh, he cannot contain himself any longer. He says, sorry, I've held back out of respect for you, but you know what? You are just wrong. It is not all of this stuff that has come on Job because he's sinned, though now, because of his suffering, he is now sinning. Interesting. And he concludes, you need, Job, to come back to God. You need to bring it all to God. Interesting. Right conclusion. Wrong application, or should it be the right way around? Right application, wrong conclusion. He did need to go to God, but he still had a link between suffering and sin. And so we come to the chapter I really want to focus on, chapter 38, where God gets the chance to speak. Do you realize in the whole of those chapters before, between chapter 2 and 38, God doesn't function directly at all. He's not actively involved in any of that. And so, notice how chapter 38 begins. Then the Lord answered Job. Isn't it interesting? So often when we're in the midst of a crisis, the thing we do is we get so absorbed in the crisis, we spin it all around in our heads, we draw our conclusions, we share our opinions, we talk to our friends, we do everything except go and listen to God, see what he says about it. We think, we talk, we conclude, we draw our conclusions, but when do we get on our knees and listen to what God has to say? Well, in chapter 38, it's almost as though God has got to that point. He can't handle it any longer. And he needs to speak. He's put up with their dreadful advice and this false thinking. And he needs to speak into the situation. He doesn't answer Job's questions directly. He doesn't follow Job's agenda. Interestingly, he doesn't say anything about all the accusations that have been made by these other parties. He just speaks to bring resolution to Job. Perhaps because Job's the only one who's been on his knees crying out to God. And God is utterly focused on him. And I'm not answering the questions, but bringing calm to the storm. Does that remind you of anything? The thing that went through my mind when I thought about this was the disciples in the boat when the storm was stirring and Jesus was asleep at the back of the boat and the waves started to toss the boat around and that even these hardened, tough disciples got terrified. They thought they were going to die. And so eventually they wake Jesus up and they say to him, "Why don't you do something? Don't you care?" Do you remember Jesus' response? Didn't address their accusations at all. He just stood, he spoke into the storm, and he brought calm. It's almost as though God has been sleeping at the back of the boat for the first 37 chapters. And he stands, and he doesn't address the accusations made. He deals by bringing peace. Not to the storm, but to Job's heart itself. And so he speaks, and he answers him. And as I put on the little note on the screen there, he answers him from a storm. In the previous chapter, Elihu had noticed that a storm was coming, and he'd mentioned this and described it as being something that speaks about God, this storm. It speaks about the strength of God, this untamable nature of God. And you know, the Bible again and again actually refers to the presence of God in the context of a storm, specifically a whirlwind. And that word storm in most translations of the Bible, not our NIV that we've used this morning, but most translations says whirlwind. Again and again that's used describing the coming of God. God brought Elijah into heaven in a whirlwind. In Psalm 77, God is present in a whirlwind. Both Isaiah and Jeremiah speak about God coming like a whirlwind. God appeared to Ezekiel in a whirlwind. And here in this passage, God speaks through a whirlwind, through a storm. There's something about a storm that seems to transcend our normal human experience, that seems to humble us, remind us of our frailty, our humanity, that speaks of something that is altogether a far greater force. When we were living in Zambia, we experienced storms on a regular basis, but there was one I remember really, really vividly. Lorinda and I were sitting one Sunday afternoon when the sun had been shining like this, in the house, the lounge of some Christian farmers, friends of ours. And as we sat there in the afternoon, suddenly this storm started to swell up. And you could hear the thunder and lightning in the distance, and we just carried on. Until suddenly, a lightning bolt struck a tree which was about 40 feet away from where we were sitting. The sound was so intense, I guarantee the conversation stopped. We were shaken to our core and deafened. I remember because the image in my head was being in the absolute silence that appeared after this strike. And I looked out of the window and I remember seeing the leaves falling off a tree. All of the leaves on the tree just fallen off instantly. And it was like confetti, but in silence because we'd been deafened. And then gradually your ears start that ringing, you know, and the sound begins to come back and you realize what's happened. The power of this storm. And every electrical device that was plugged in the house blew up. TV blew up. And the power in those days at night didn't come from a generator, because they didn't want to keep a generator on, but they charged batteries, big, huge lorry lead batteries. And they're all in a room, and because of the force of the lightning, they all exploded. And there was lead covering an inch of the floor in this room because of the power of a storm. And it was a humbling experience. That's how God speaks to Job. You get the sense that it begins this process of realigning Job's perspective. So verse 2, he says, "Who is this who obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you will answer." Interesting, isn't it? Job had expected God to answer his question. But actually, God is going to be the one asking the questions. And they're all rhetorical questions. They're all questions that no human being could ever have answered. He's pointing out how far above humans he is. He's realigning that perspective. What I want to do is to put those questions on the screen for each of the verses as they come up. So in the first, verses 4 to 7, he says, the question essentially is, do you know the secrets of the creation of the world? Were you there at the beginning when the world was created? There's a reminder here that God is from the ancient times. He is eternal. We speak of God's entire universe lying in the palm of his hand. And you think your world and your problems are too big for me? There's a reminder here of just how much Job and we just don't know. If Job couldn't even give God an answer to these questions about how God had created the world, how could he possibly begin? If he didn't know about measurements and the things about the way God had put things together, how could he begin to challenge God about his secrets and his judgments about how people live their lives? Do you know, all of these things point to the sovereignty of God. And God is saying this not to humiliate Job, but he is saying it to humble him. And when you see there at the end, the morning stars sing together and all the angels shouting for joy. There's a picture here of an angelic blessing of God, praising God for his wonderful, astonishing workmanship in creation. So how can any of us complain when the things that we do in life don't always work out quite right and our endeavors? There's a challenge to see God is above all of this. Second question. It's to do with, do you know the boundaries of the sea? How far can you see a perspective? Where was Job on the second day of creation when God separated the sea from the land? When the clouds appeared in the sky, Job wasn't there, was he? So he had absolutely no idea when this was done, how it was done. His eyes couldn't even see the boundaries of where the land meets the sea, the other side of the Sea of Galilee. let alone begin to see these boundaries on the oceans of the world. Do you realize that today we have so much more knowledge of what does exist in our planets? And yet we still, even though we've got irrefutable proof of the oceans around us, the continents, we've got much greater understanding, there's still controversy about whether the world's flat or not. People still question the evolutionary process of creation. We are so far behind God's understanding. And he was there from the very beginning. And at the beginning, before the beginning of time, God knew all about you. And we want to challenge God about the timing of things. Third question. Do you understand the nature of the earth? Did you arrange each morning for the sun to appear as clockwork? No, of course you didn't. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, the source of the great seas, or walked in the recesses of the deep? This is lovely language, isn't it? Job is described as being a man who had sheep and camels and donkeys. You get the sense he knew the desert. I don't think he was much of a beach guy, so I suspect he didn't know what was going on in the seas. He may well have gone up a mountain and seen one or two rivers, but had he put the pieces together in the jigsaw to see that that's where this spring ends up becoming a mighty river and then an ocean? Again, when I was in Africa, when we were in Africa, in Zambia, we did see the source of one mighty river. The mighty Zambezi River. I found this photograph on my computer last night. This is the source of the mighty Zambezi River. It doesn't look very much, it looks like a puddle in the middle of a forest. Well, it is. But when you got to the source, you could see water bubbling up from the center of it. And just to prove that we were there, is a photograph of a very young Lorinda. I'm in trouble for that later on. The source of a river that flows for 2,500 kilometers, that has so much water in it, and its maximum flow, there are more than, you know how much a cubic meter of water is, don't you? That's about a cubic meter of water. This river has in it, at its maximum flow, 18,000 cubic meters a second. And the best place to see it is at Victoria Falls. That bubbling of water ends up with these mighty falls, the largest waterfalls in the world. And that is only a third, between a third and a half of the way down the length of the river. It goes through six countries before it comes out in the Indian Ocean. Can you begin to get your head around this? And God's saying to Job, have you been to the source of the mighty rivers? This is the world I created. And you're worried about what you're going through? Because you somehow think, I don't know about these things. And going into the deep, I'm pretty confident he wasn't a diver, so he wouldn't have seen a turtle. But the depths that we get a glimpse of, this is the God that we have. This is the world he does know intimately. Next question, do you comprehend the nature of light, darkness, and the sky? I wonder how simplistic his view of day and night was. The sun coming up each day, the night, well, it doesn't seem to be there, so we rest and we don't do anything. Today, you know, we can answer an awful lot more questions because science has given us an ability to do that. But I get the sense that Job couldn't begin to imagine that the sun is 93 million miles away. It's not just a blob up in the sky. It's 93 million miles away, if I remember correctly. Or that the moon that shines at night isn't actually shining, it's just reflecting the light of the sun that's at the other side of the earth, as long as the earth's not flat. And both perfectly positioned to give just the right amount of light and warmth. Do you know, The maximum temperature on our Earth is 58 degrees. You probably didn't know that. That's quite warm. Do you know, if you were the nearest planet to the Sun, Mercury, the temperature would be 450 degrees. I'd like to be the BBC putting that one on a wall chart in the morning. This morning, the temperature would be 450 degrees. Toasty. If you were on one of the planets furthest from the Sun, Neptune, it would be minus 200 degrees. But God has placed us here on Earth. The temperature, perfect. I wonder whether we have the faith to believe that whatever we're going through, nonetheless, we are in just the right position and location and situation every day for God to provide as he said he would for all of our needs. That's the lesson for Job. Next question from the next few verses. Do you understand the nature of rain and its effects? In the previous section, God had been speaking about the wisdom, his wisdom in managing snow and hail. And now he speaks of how he engineers channels for the torrents of rain. Because it was a lovely day yesterday. I was in the garden and I was doing a little bit of engineering myself. A little bit of landscaping, sorting the garden out, making it more perfect so that the water does what it wants to do and the weeds don't. And at the end of it, you know, you look back on all the digging that you've done and you think to yourself, yeah, not bad, Steve, well done. Yeah, you've done quite a lot today. And you look at my great landscaping genius and you think, yeah. And then you look at the Grand Canyon and you think, yeah, God does it bigger, doesn't he? He does it so much more. Do we imagine that God cannot cope with the runoff of your life and the issues that we find ourselves going through? Do you know the nature of the constellations? Okay, if Job wasn't familiar with the sea, he would have known the night sky better than you and I, I'm sure. The Pleiades, Orion's Belt, he'd have seen that. Had a look, I've got a little app on my phone, and Orion's Belt is still around. You see it in the world around us, still. And you can see it even during the daytime, where it is. Those constellations, to him, would have seemed flat on the sky. Here's Orion's Belt. This is what it looks like. The belt is these three stars here. And they look like they're so close together, especially as the whole of Orion is actually just over there normally, just above the horizon. But what he wouldn't have begun to even got close to understanding is that actually those three stars that make up the belt are so far apart from one another in actuality that we measure unimaginable distances in terms of light years. That's the God who puts these stars into the sky. I wonder whether Job could have even begun to contemplate that even during the daytime, the constellations are still there. It's just that the sun is so bright that the dirt in our atmosphere and the dust reflects the sun, so we can't see them any longer. The year before Lorinda and I came back from Zambia, we had the privilege of experiencing a tola. Tola? What's a tola? Sounds like a chocolate bar. We didn't. A total solar eclipse. Total solar eclipse occurs because, guess what? The moon is just the perfect size, the distance from us, that it appears to be exactly the same size as the sun when it comes in front of it. And so when it's completely eclipsing, you can actually see the flare glowing around it on the outside. Amazing. When we saw it, we experienced a whole series of interesting things. But as the eclipse came up, you notice really strange things that my head can't get around. Like the fact that when the sun comes, shines through the leaves of the trees, when there's an eclipse and the point of light is so precise, just before you get there, all the shadows, all the light that comes between the leaves are in the shape of a sickle. They're no longer points, they're in a sickle shape because of reflecting that. that the shadows around a person are very sharp on one side of the person and very fuzzy on the other side as you come into the shadow, as you come into the eclipse. And then after the eclipse, when the light's on the other side, suddenly the shadow is fuzzy on the other side and sharp on the other. My mind can't cope with this sort of stuff. It's just amazing. We had a Great Dane with us, and the day that, because it became so dark, the dog just went to sleep. Thought it's night time, I'll have a kip. He started snoring for 5 minutes, and the birds stopped singing, the grasshoppers all stopped, and it was night time, and you could see the constellations. They were all there. Could Job begin to understand this stuff? This is the God who is responsible for our lives. And yet we get so anxious about the problems that don't resolve themselves instantly. And God has put all this into place. Do you know the nature of clouds, weather, and the human mind? That was the next question. Well, we've already considered light and seas and the stars, but now God brings Job back to this imminent storm. What's around him? Could he control these things, the storm? Isn't it interesting that in our modern science, we've learned so much about many of these phenomena? We understand something about distances and measurements and meteorological phenomena. We've got all sorts of clearer understanding about gravitational forces and things like that. But just like Job, just like the disciples, just like us, we can't begin to control any of it. And yet our God is the one who determines the course of storms, all in his hands. Today we have got wisdom and understanding on so many different areas. And yet, I want to suggest to you, we are absolutely no closer to truly being able to answer any of the questions that God presented to Job. At best, we've kind of filled in some of the small detail about how the world works, but there is a vast chasm between human understanding and God's wisdom. These are the lessons he encourages Job to learn. One final one. Do you understand and master the animal kingdom? In this next section, and actually the whole of the next chapter, he brings things home to things that he might understand a bit more, the natural world around him. And in this first one, he challenges Job to realize he can't even hunt for the prey that you'd give to a lion. I don't know about you, but you know, I'm at the limit of things when I try to remember to feed the fish every day. It's been one of my joys this week to pop out at lunchtime and sprinkle a little bit of food out and feed the fish. But, you know, that's about as good as I get in my management. God created a world and designed a self-sufficient world in which plants are provided to feed herbivores, and herbivores feed carnivores, and so it goes on. We call them food chains, and those food chains are so complex, actually we refer to them as food webs, and the food webs are so amazing in their complexity, right up to the point where we start to interfere with them, that actually they make human inventions, including the World Wide Web, the internet, look chaotic, ridiculous in their naivety. This is the God that Job invites him to understand. So I want him to invite us to do something similar, to understand it. I want to give you just some few basic conclusions. The first, did you realize that in all of this, none of those human questions were addressed at all? At the end of this episode, Job was left ignorant about this event that had taken place between Satan and God, though he did explain to him that Satan had been defeated. That comes in passages when he speaks about a Leviathan a bit later. He speaks about the victory over Satan. And so what he does is he gives him an assurance about the past, the present, and the future. Same assurance that we've been singing about, the confidence we have in Jesus. But the human questions were not answered. He was not following the agenda of a human being. It was just God revealing himself. He gave a completely new perspective to Job. Do you know, when we're in that crisis point, the thing that I want to encourage us most to seek is God's perspective. To seek to see a God who, like a storm, like the Grand Canyon, is just so much bigger than we can begin to comprehend, and start to gain his perspective. And in the process, when it was God who was glimpsed, peace was restored. And at this point, you see this man whose life was changed as he began to see what was happening, just like the disciples when the storm was calmed and peace came into the boat. When he looked away out of his own situation and he saw who God truly was, omniscient, all-knowing, omnipresent everywhere, this whole world is nothing to him in its complexity. Omnipotent, all-powerful, he began to give him a sense of confidence and peace. And finally, it was a lesson in relationship. Brought him back, just the very presence of God reminded of him that things were okay. And this was his response in chapter 42. I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Sometimes we have to wait for God to resolve issues. Even after this, when this man had peace with his God, everything didn't fall into place. Those things came later. But life with our God is often a lesson of learning, of gaining his perspective, of seeing where he is in all of it. And I want to encourage anyone who's really struggling, as many do, because of all sorts of things, that we have a God who is above and greater than all. I want to encourage you first and foremost to go to him and hear his voice. It's why that's our priority next Sunday, to listen for his voice. It's why listening to his word is so important. I'm all for encouraging people to read Bible study notes. That's fine, that leads us in. But you know, reading his word again and again invites God to speak directly. And because of the church that we are and the people that we meet, many of us have an opportunity to stand alongside people who are going through tough times. I want to give an encouragement to you. If that's what you are finding yourself doing, I want to encourage you to point people to God. Don't try to be a Job's comforter. So often, the thing we need to do with people who are struggling and in horrible situations is actually shut our mouths and not give advice, but just somehow point to God. Very often when I see people, I'll listen to whatever they're going through, but I will end by just reading some scriptures, giving them a glimpse of who God is once more. May God speak to us. Read this passage, read the rest of it, and just see who this God is and have your mind blown wide apart. There's one thing this church and the church in this nation needs desperately. It needs a bigger picture of who God is. Let's pray.